Welcome to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here for this episode. If you're new here, allow me to introduce myself. I'm C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest. I've written a number of things for a number of publications. I'm doing a lot of writing for World Magazine these days on their editorial page, op-eds and all that kind of stuff. I am also a senior editor for Touchstone Magazine. Okay, let's kick it over to you, Tom, and then we'll go to Glenn, and Glenn's got the subject of the day.
All right. I'm Tom Price. I teach systematic theology, Christian ethics, philosophy, a few other things at one of the places, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary.
All right.
And I'm Glenn Sunshine. I'm a retired history professor, senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, Ministry Associated Reflections Ministries, and I've got my own ministry as well called Every Square Inch Ministries, esquareinch.org. The topic today, I was sent an article from the Free Press about a movement I had never heard of. It's called the 4B movement. And this is a movement coming out of radical feminism, probably originating in Korea, that really seems to be the center of it. And the 4Bs are, as near as I can tell, the B is the first letter in the Korean word for no. And the 4Bs are no dating, no sex, no marriage, no children. And this is a movement among Korean feminists. Estimates of the number of people who are actually part of it range from 5,000 to 50,000. And the reason why this is getting reported here, it started in 2019. The reason why this is getting reported now is apparently there's a movement on TikTok where 4B is becoming a topic of conversation among women on TikTok. So I thought it would be worth taking a look at this in a little bit more detail and sort of teasing out some of the implications of it. One of the most obvious is it may be responsible for Korea's birth dearth. And to put that in perspective, Korea has the lowest birth rate of any country in the world. It is currently at about 0.7, which is one-third of replacement rate.
Yeah, if I remember from the article, it's even lower in Seoul.
Yeah, in Seoul, it's about 0.6. 0.59, they said. And to put the effect of this in perspective, according to the article, which was written by somebody in Korea, there are about 150 schools in Korea that this year had no one entering first grade. Basically, if the trend continues, Korea is going to run out of Koreans, South Korea at least.
Yeah, I had a conversation with someone in my church who owns a business that works internationally, and he mentioned that they're already planning to move this particular company that he was working with or negotiating with. They're already planning to move out of the country because they know that they will not be able to sustain the business in Korea.
Yeah. Now, the first thing that occurs to me is in modern Western societies where there is a substantial social safety net, form of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever, what happens when you stop having children? What happens when the demographic curve goes down? One of the practical implications that they're really not considering is as they get older, they will, obviously not have children to take care of them, but also the government is going to be starved of the resources, the money that it needs to maintain any kind of social safety net.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you see with this phenomenon, and it's everywhere, is a kind of a free-riding behavior, largely because the effects are so diffused. In other words, when you can see a direct impact between what you do and how it affects you, you've got a, you know, kind of a closed loop. You can see that. But when you have something like this, where you say, well, you know, we have this social safety net, which is not even like something stated. It's more just part of the, I guess, atmosphere or kind of the cultural ethos. And people just more or less take it for granted. And I think a lot of folks just don't even think about it. I mean, they don't think about how this thing actually works. They more or less just assume that it just does, and they don't see how their own behavior affects it.
I don't know enough about, you know, the history of kind of how, you know, again, how these things originally develop. I do know enough about feminism, of how it gets exported and then it takes on peculiar cultural forms. I didn't get a chance to go in depth with the article. Did it say anything about how this kind of did it? Because I understand it's a very Christian nation on one side.
Let me just address that, Tom. I had a conversation with somebody just this last Sunday, and I made the statement Korea has the lowest birth rate in the world, and this guy couldn't believe it because it is in Asia the most Christian nation there, which I think is worth thinking about, because apparently there is no kind of leavening or salt influence.
Yeah.
At least when it comes to this matter, yeah. And let me just put it out here. Many of the most woke people I know are Koreans. I mean, in the States, in my denomination.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, I did a little extra research on this, and a lot of it is a reaction to a culture in Korea that is, as they put it, excessively patriarchal. That sees women primarily in terms of their reproductive capacities. And interestingly enough, that pushes really stringent beauty standards on women. Korea is the 10th largest consumer of cosmetics in the world and the third largest exporter of cosmetics.
Well, let's pause there a second there, Glenn, because I question that. I know, the reason I question it, it's not like Korea became patriarchal yesterday. They didn't have a problem with the birth rate. In fact, at the end of the Korean War, there were so many excess children that, you know, adopting Korean children was like a big deal. Now, obviously, there were the people who lost parents and stuff like that, but I don't think there's any connection. In fact, if there would be a connection, it would be the opposite. More patriarchal you are, in terms of actual fact, not just in terms of attitudes, the more likely you're going to have a lot of kids.
Well, except here's the problem. Given that kind of cultural context as it was understood in Korea, when feminism began growing in Korea, it reacted against this. So you get a reaction against the idea that women are primarily, you know, that, you know, these beauty standards. You start getting women destroying cosmetics. You get them rejecting fashion. You get them doing all of these kinds, shaving their heads, all kinds of things of this sort, as a reaction against that. Now, how widespread that was, I don't know, but it apparently was a noticeable trend. Then you have the Korean version of the Me Too movement adds into it. And those two things are seen as being the roots to 4B.
You know, well, again, I would
again,
challenge
the reaction
it
against the culture and these other things.
But I would challenge it again on a different level. I'm not challenging you. I'm challenging the interpretation of the writer. And this is a global phenomenon, and we see it in the West in various places. They may not call it 4B, but you see similar attitudes and sort of groups that form around that project. You know, if you think about, you know, what is The Handmaid's Tale all about? It's basically a story in which a kind of dystopia is envisioned that justifies childlessness and a kind of rejection of motherhood. So, I see this as a very complicated matter, and I also think that there are other factors in play. Population density and apartment living are a huge factor. Wherever people live mostly in apartments, fertility goes down, and that's certainly the case in Korea.
What I would say, I think you're right kind of across the board, and actually the article talks about some of those things. We'll get into that in a minute, I suspect. But what this is the 4B specifically is the Korean expression of these movements that exist in, well, really across the world. And you see it, among other things, for example, in the political divide that you have in America between men and women. You know, a few years ago, 52% of men defined themselves as feminists. Now it's down to 43%. Women are getting more and more liberal. Men are getting more and more conservative. And this kind of split that's occurring here, which also is happening, by the way, in China, in the UK, in Germany, in all kinds of countries, even in China, which I found rather interesting, this kind of split is also at work in Korea. The last Korean president ran on a pronatalist, anti-feminist a platform and won overwhelmingly because he got all the male vote. You know, so, but, you know, so that's in Korea. But we see a similar kind of divide happening across the industrialized world. You're seeing a growth in antinatalism. You're seeing a growth in people who'd rather have pets than children. You're seeing, you know, all kinds of things of that sort that are around. Now, we're not as bad as the Koreans. Most Gen Z say they want to have children at some point. But, you know, so you don't quite have this complete antinatalist program. On the other hand, they're delaying marriage so long, I don't think they quite understand the drop in fertility that occurs after the 20s.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, as you guys know, my church is something of an exception to this rule where we have half of our, church population literally under the age of like 15. So there's just lots and lots of kids. But that's a very, you know, we're a very unusual church.
That's a whole new approach to church growth.
Yeah. That's right. Well, actually, it's the old one.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and ours is very similar. I mean, we have some families have 10 plus kids, and, you know, it's quite a variety. And you do see a different embrace of a fuller vision of Christian faith, and I think just being a creature. But there is this kind of, this is one of the things that I reflect a lot upon, just, you know, especially theologically, is something so fundamental to our constitution as a creature, to be procreative, the continuance, and such a turn against the human and the humane that happened after such a rigorous humanism dominated so much of the West and got exported. And you see, I mean, there are different layers to it, of course. We know the spiritual level we talk about a lot, but, you know, of course, there's the technological and the advances on that end that have changed interdependency. So now you can have, you know, for example, females in a lot of societies are not as dependent in the immediate generation because they can find work or they don't have to be a part of a family. And so they're happy enough in some cases, or they claim to be, with the freedom from not having to be a wife, not having to be a mother, to go travel or buy what they, you know, these kinds of things. And again, we see it across the board. It's not just there. I have a lot of family, older, you know, 30s, 40s, no kids, love traveling, but they're getting to a point where, you know, the shift's going to happen. And I always reflect on what is it about this kind of form of modernity and rejection, a lot of what's central to us as creatures, what suppresses that natural desire so strongly to where you pretty much, you're almost anti-human in some sense.
Yeah. It's worth noting that in Genesis, the first command we see God giving us is reproduce and multiply.
Yeah.
It's part of our nature.
But I think that there's also a very strong kind of rejection of nature and its imperatives in modernity. We've talked about Baconian science and the mastery of nature and the idea that we are not really subject to it. It should be subject to us. Now, the one exception to this would be ecological concerns. But apart from that, there's very much a sense that nature lacks any authority, to tell me what to do.
But the ecological one is a puzzling one, because on the one hand, what is interesting in most of the ecological conversations that I've been a part of or listened to or read about is that there is this deep concern for the environment, to where it's okay almost to be, look at Pope Francis's shift. Great emphasis on creation and the care for it, but almost this, a purposeful shift to a creation-centered ethic away from quote-unquote an anthropocentric. And again, I think both are problematic. When you're properly theocentric, the others can fall into place the right way. You don't have to be either or. But I get it's a chastisement of the exploitative notion of a human-centered ethic of the Enlightenment. I get it, the Baconian. But one of the things that kind of internalizes for people who follow it is that there is something wrong with the human as natural. And for some reason, everything in the environment is great, but we stop with the human because the human is the problem. So there is a kind of internalized understanding of the fall in some ways. The human has fallen out of sync with the rest of creation to exploit or abuse it. But rather than a redemptive possibility, it becomes a kind of negation of the human. And
I think related to that is sometimes people even use the ecological crisis to justify a post-familial, antinatal attitude. Because, after all, we're in that view that you just mentioned, Tom, the problem. We are the problem that needs to be solved. And so the way to do that is not have kids.
Yeah. Have you ever noticed, by the way, if you've ever watched Planet Earth or any of the Richard Attenborough things, you never see people. But if you watch the making of, you will always find people, native populations or whatever, right next to where they're filming, but they very carefully film it in such a way, or cut it in such a way, that you never see them.
That's a good observation, and kind of the embarrassment at the presence of humanity. I'm in a part of the country, as you guys know, where we've got lots of open space. Compared to the East, it's just remarkable how different kind of the countryside is. In New England, one town presses up right to another, and you just don't spend much time in kind of wild spaces or even open farmland. By the time you get out to where you are, Glenn, in Indiana, of course, you've got huge farms. But out here, we have just vast spaces that are undeveloped. And I'm not at all, complaining. Yeah, it's kind of cool. But at the same time, we have this land crisis and this stress on density that's kind of puzzling in light of the fact that there's just so much open space. Here people will, it's not at all unusual for people to drive an hour just to go to the grocery store. It just because things are so spread out and people are used to it, and you're not dealing with traffic a lot of times. You're just cruising along at 80 miles an hour. And it doesn't bother you too much. But back east, the same distance would seem like something you'd only try to attempt it every year. But I guess the thing I'm getting at here is just our attitudes towards space, our attitudes toward the natural world, all these things come into play when it comes to kind of an justification of antinatal attitudes. But I wonder too about density itself. So I mentioned a minute ago, if you want the population to go down, just make everybody live in apartments. And there's just, it's undeniable. There's just lots of studies out along that line. I watched a video here on Korea the other day, and they said in this video that the problem with Korea is Seoul. Basically, everything is in Seoul in terms of economic, life and the government and all this kind of stuff. And it just forces people into these extremely expensive places to live.
Yeah.
And it's awfully hard to think just at a practical level about having kids, even if you want them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, the kind of things that are open to us now in terms of temptations when we do have incomes, right? People can have quote unquote lifestyles. And I think that becomes an attractive thing. And that is hard to fund, you know, when everything else is expensive. And even if you're making good money, usually it's going to be lifestyle or children. And when they're younger, they can kind of, you know, think that you're going to have endless time. Time isn't going to, you know, things aren't going to shift. And then, you know, you find out, you wake up one day, you're, you know, 50 years old, no family, you know, fewer friends. And okay, you can have a quote unquote lifestyle, but you have changed often at that point. And the things that attracted you once don't. And then you wake up in a bad situation.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes on the ecological front, if a lot of the ecological concern really centers in, you know, the people who are really most engaged with this and most fired up by it. I wonder if it's true that they're mostly in cities or on the coasts.
That strikes me as a sound observation based just on my own anecdotal, you know, evidence.
I know one of the things that drives people in the West, not all the way on the left coast there, but in the West a bit crazy, is land use policies that are set in Washington by people who have no idea what's going on the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, or they just don't care about what's happening on the ground. Maybe even are antagonistic. So here, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, once you get outside of Portland and Seattle, it's a very different world. It's very red. It's very Trumpish. It's very socially conservative. It's very, hunting, you know, sort of outdoor life kind of thing. The people in the cities, of course, there's just so many of them, and they have attitudes about the wilderness that are convenient for them because they think about, you know, the wilderness as a place to recreate. They don't think about it as a place to live. They get their Keen shoes on, which are made in Portland, and their Columbia jackets, and then they go down into the gorge and maybe do a little windsurfing or a little hiking on, you know, up Mount Hood or something. And then they're back, you know, working for Nike or Microsoft or Amazon, and doing all of their cool, you know, hipster neighborhood stuff. But the people who actually live those areas aren't terribly, upbeat about these interlopers who come out every once in a while and do stuff. And so we actually have breakaway movements out here. So the eastern side of Oregon, which is kind of weird to say, because you know when I was back on the East Coast, West was the wild place, and the East was the further east you got, further you got, you know, closer you got to the coastline. It's the reverse here. So here, the wild area is eastern. So further you get away from the coast. So, but we have a breakaway movement in Oregon that's pretty serious. I think every county outside of Portland or pretty close to it has voted to join Idaho, literally to break away and become part of Idaho. Now, the problem is Idaho is itself being flooded with people from places like California and stuff like that. And so there's a lot of concern about the future of some of these places. You know, if you think about like Montana, you know, well, it depends on where you are in Montana. If you're in Missoula or if you're in, you know, one of the kind of cool places to live, it's very blue. But you get outside into the part of the state that we associate with kind of the Montana mood or whatever you want to call it. It's not that at all. And it's, you know, it's what you expect, people with guns and hunters and ranchers and stuff. And that's what we have here.
Yeah. And it seems to me that my wife, Lynn, was a wildlife management major. And the people who do that, by and large, aren't the tree huggers.
Yeah.
They're people who want to understand how to manage the environment to preserve it in a way that is viable for, you know, long term.
So now we know why she married you, Glenn. You're this wild man from
managing wildlife. Yeah. Then she got a nursing degree and then she was a preschool teacher, and those three things together make her qualified to be a mother. The point is that, the people there are concerned about, the climate, they're concerned about the environment and all that, but they've got a much more practical way of looking at it, and they are much closer to the ground, and they frankly understand it a whole lot better than the people in the cities making the policies.
That's definitely the complaint I hear from people that are knowledgeable, say, about, forest management. So if you think about, the wildfires that we regularly have to live with here in the West, and you know the wildfire season has occurred because smoke is in the air, a lot of it has to do with kind of Rousseauian philosophies of wildlife management. The idea of being just leave it completely alone. Yeah. Let the brush build up down low, let it get all dried out. And then it doesn't, when I was a kid, as you guys can remember, Smokey Bear and all that kind of stuff, it's all about, human beings, unintentionally starting fires in the wilderness. No, it's not that all the time. Sometimes it's just a lightning strike. And the next thing you've got this enormous conflagration that's just eating up things. And if there had just been more active work invested in managing the land, we wouldn't have this. But that's anathema to a lot of these folks.
That's kind of a similar point I was making before with the desire in having children. What is it against our contribution to things that isn't a part of the natural? I mean, even the social. I mean, there is this thing that everything the human does is artifice and is somehow either to be blessed completely, if it's a self-expression, that no matter how deviant it is, especially against our created nature, but it's to be cursed whenever it's in accord with cultivating properly, caring for properly, procreating. There's this distortion. I understand its root, but there is this distortion that we see everywhere, and there's another case. Let natural be that which doesn't allow the human in its relationship to things to understand that part of its task is having dominion the right way, is caring for and cultivating and using its intelligence to say, you know what, those leaves built up over a long time, dry, windy conditions, lightning, bad for the environment.
In terms of forest management, it seems to me we've got two choices. We either let small wildfires burn, which is okay, then you don't get these massive conflagrations, which is the way it was naturally done, or you actively go in and manage it and clear the brush and all of that kind of stuff, get rid of the dead wood, all of that sort of stuff. Yeah. Those are the only two ways you prevent these large-scale wildfires, it seems to me.
You know, Glenn, I'd like to take us back to the article that we started with.
What article?
Oh, we had a...
And the reason is because, the writer is commiserating. So there is a complaint. In other words, it's not merely this is what's happening. My sense is that she is alarmed by what's happening. And she's wondering how men and women will even trust each other enough to marry and have children when these attitudes seem to be moving them in completely different directions. You know, at one point she says something that it doesn't follow for me, and I think she's implying that if men were more liberal, we'd have more kids. I don't actually think that's the case.
Nah.
You know, I have, like you guys, extended family, and it's only the conservative women who have kids in that extended family. Now some of those women are actually married, but they're not very fruitful. In other words, these liberal women are not very fruitful. So it's not as though this is going to be solved if we make men more liberal. It seems to me that we need to see a revalorization of motherhood as an important calling that only women can fulfill.
And I think coupled with that is we're dealing, again, we're talking about an area in this case with a large Christian presence. And the answer to bad forms of anything are better forms of it for a Christian, right? So the answer to, say, bad families out there that are broken and don't do things the right way because of the fall is not to eradicate families, okay? It's to have families with their loves ordered the right way and challenged to do it that way. So the answer to bad forms of patriarchy, to take their argument, is not to eliminate patriarchy. It's to have the right form challenged by the scripture and the right way, because built into enacting ourselves the way God created things is the life manifesting presence of God when it's done the right way. Reacting with a bad answer to a bad problem rather than addressing the hard realities of it never end well. And so we see this over and over again. The best way to get rid of the fact that, you know, children have been abused in the world or hurt or suffered is not to have them, right? I don't want to bring kids in the world because it's so bad, right? No. How about bring them into the world and also loving them and creating a different set of conditions, you know?
Yeah, you know, related to that, when it comes to, you know, harm done to children, certainly a badly ordered home or one in which people are living for their own disordered desires and children are in the way and all that kind of stuff is a significant problem.
Yeah.
Sometimes progressives immediately turn to a government sort of managed approach, with the conviction that, you know, with the kind of oversight that we want to exercise over governmental programs, we'll be able to address these problems. Well, I want you to know that's just naive. A lot of abuse occurs in foster care.
Yeah.
A lot of abuse occurs in terms of neglect government or, you know, involvement in these matters. We do need to see parents rising to the occasion and doing the job right, but there is no government's there's just simply no government substitute for good parents.
Yeah, and I think good parents and well-formed homes are proper byproducts of properly done church and theology. I'm not just saying being Christian. I'm talking about taking those Christian things seriously.
Well, but here's getting back to my earlier observation about kind of left-wing kind of trends in the Christian world.
Yeah.
You could say some of that has to do with maybe a pietism that emphasized a personal relationship with Jesus at the expense of family life, or maybe without intending to. In other words, just saying, more or less assuming that it would take care of itself, you know, that pronatal attitudes would just follow if people were doing their Bible reading every day. But in fact, though, what I've seen is almost a kind of lionization of the post-familial in certain church settings, and the celebration of a kind of almost universal celibacy on the part of Protestants to just kind of give their all to XYZ Corp for the glory of God.
Yeah. And I've noticed also increase, just to, you know, kind of my, this is again, just personal experience of things, but I've noticed that a lot of these kind of trendy churches, a lot of the people that are always talking about their faith, they're always talking about themselves. It is always about, you know, themselves. And you see that kind of hyper individualist pietism that has spilled over into the individual expressivism, to where, you know, God is a function now, and theology and church are functions of our self and our self benefit, a kind of self actualization ethic, if you will. And again, you're right on track here. I think this gets spread, and it gets spread in theologies, and cultivate enough of that kind of pietism, even with its strong biblical kind of, you know, gloss. And as soon as the self starts to, you know, show itself in its right place, you know, this is what we get. And I think a lot of the criticisms of certain trends in I speak as a Protestant, in Protestantism that hyper-emphasized the individualism were valid critiques. I think a classic Christian understanding, reading the fathers and reading through the medieval period, no perfect stress, but you tended to see being both is it the uniqueness of the gift in its being nothing apart from its relational capacities. And those relationships are central, family, church, you know, all those kind of.
Now here's where the typical kind of make everybody happy pastor will raise a finger of protest and say, but what about that woman who wants to be married and have children, but she's in her 40s and has kind of, lost that window of opportunity? What about her? Well, yeah, we don't build around that. Certainly we try to reach people where they're at, but we have to focus on the fundamental building blocks of a healthy culture and stress those, yeah. And then try to help those for whom the opportunities were either for lost because maybe there was a period of life where they just didn't have their priorities straight, or opportunities were never present. You know, there are these realities, but you don't build a culture around the exceptions. You build them around the fundamental institutions and the things that help to sustain those institutions.
And that's right. There are plenty of exceptions, and I think the Christian life is such that a fully meaningful participation in the community of faith, the church, in its vibrant life of families and children, everything else, are all part of what it means for you to be a Christian. So you're not cut off from that. It just may not be based on either bad decisions or just, you know, God's larger purposes in a sense of providence. Some people can't have children. Doesn't mean that they can't be meaningfully a part of all of that and be shaped by it and shape others. I mean, that's part of being committed to the mission of the church, is to be invested in the lives of these people. And so you're not left out. We're just talking about the larger cultural task of carrying our faith and being salt and light from generation till generation until redemption's had its full swing with creation.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been noticing, I've been teaching through Malachi lately, and one of the things that a passage on marriage that we really don't usually discuss is Malachi 3, where he's talking about, well, first of all, marrying foreign wives and trying to continue to worship God. But the second part is divorce. And the interesting thing there is, you know, he talks about how that people are, with the one flesh union, God also gives his spirit to unite them, so that they're supposed to be united both bodily and, well, spiritually. And God says, now, why did I do that? Because I wanted godly offspring. Yeah. And I have never run into anybody talking about marriage who talked about it in terms of God's intent in sexuality, in the one flesh union, in the spiritual union in marriage, is children.
Yeah.
In fact, that's been almost dismissed as too embarrassing to bring up. You know, even in like premarital counseling, I think the practice has fallen into not bringing it up with like when you're a pastor. So when I am, you know, doing premarital counseling, the first thing I do is I warn them that I will only use the traditional vows, and if they're looking for something else, the Unitarians are just right over there, you know. But the other thing is that it's assumed that if people can bear children, they will bring children into the world, and that's part of the package. When we talk about, you know, one flesh union, this is assumed. Now, obviously, you know, there are people who can't, and but that's very different than people who won't. And so, you know, we need to counsel people to be open to children, and even get into the fact that for the vast, you know, majority of the history of the church, contraception was viewed by every branch as off limits.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how recently that change occurred among the Protestants. Yeah. It started in the 1930s when the Anglican Church permitted contraception under limited circumstances. You know, there were specific things that she said, all right, if this is the case, then. But it went from there to, you know, no holds barred. I mean, you know, anything, you know, any reason at all, you just go with it.
Tracing those steps is, I think, key to getting a hold of a lot of what we're talking about, at least especially in relationship to the church's attitude, because that shift immediately to, okay, we're going to make some accommodation to, you know, we always talk about the, you know, the kind of slippery slope. Well, here we go, slippery slope. And to where I don't think a lot of, you know, evangelicals and Protestants, even, you know, those that would principally be conservative, would you know, even think twice that it's a problem. Right. And
well, and the reason why the slope is slippery is because human nature is slippery.
Yeah.
We are given to taking the easy road whenever it presents itself. And if I am interested primarily in my own immediate happiness and don't have any sort of connection to a larger project, well, things are going to be slippery.
Yeah. You know, another way that, you know, we talked about that hideous strength and how prophetic it was. One of the things that is a trend in Japan, it started in Japan, but we're also seeing it now in Korea, is the idea that, well, and actually to some extent in America as well, that people don't really even want to have sexual activity.
Yeah.
You know, their relationships are just too messy.
Yeah.
And so what happens, I'll get back to Lewis in a second. What happens? Guys, actually, and increasingly women go to porn and things like that because there's no commitment, there's no messy emotional attachments, nothing like that. What does Lewis say about the moon? He says that the beings on the moon have given up sexual relations with each other, and instead they engage in sexual relations with cleverly designed images it almost comes across like sex bots, you know. Yeah. But that is actually the state of these groups in, like I said, in Japan. It's certainly a large movement, especially it was unusual considering Japan was very, very oversexed for a while. It seems to be the case with Korea, I strongly suspect. And we're seeing it even with young people in the United States.
Yeah, which is such a weird thing, having, you know, grown up in the 60s and 70s, where, you know, the problem was exactly the opposite, where kids were just, and then we had a lot of very virile guys kind of just going out, you know, and trying to have as many women as possible. And it wasn't as though there was no pornography in those days. Obviously, it was more difficult to acquire, but I don't think anybody who wanted it couldn't get it. You know, I remember those days well.
And I think, especially in the U.S., you had social attitudes changing, especially in 60s and 70s. You did have it happening prior to that. It just wasn't as out there. But one of the things you also see is, again, these kind of steps. I mean, similarly, I mean, I remember growing up in the 70s, and it was very different. But I also, you know, I grew up in Virginia, and we still had enough of the kind of old Southern culture to where people still would get married or find someone right around the end or even in high school and drop out. And some of them are still together to this day. People I remember, you know, and it's kind of stunning now. They're, you know, great grandparents and the like. But you did have the kind of the person, you know, the kind of the guy who wanted all the ladies and the like. And then you started to see that they could kind of not be held accountable as much because social attitudes changed. Plus, with contraception and the like, the consequences of what otherwise would be natural behavior and its fruit didn't come back to haunt them. And then you have, you know, you open up abortion on demand, basically. And so the consequences for certain kind of natural byproducts of promiscuity are no longer there. So oftentimes it doesn't change the behavior. But in this case, strangely, I think the curse is the flip side. You've gotten to where now people don't want to even have anything to do with each other.
Well, this brings up something I think doesn't get brought up very much, except by people like me who spent a lot of time thinking about the productive household and the transition to the industrial economy. So in the productive household, where a man and a woman were working together alongside each other all day long, and there weren't the kinds of distractions that we take for granted today, like entertainment and that kind of stuff. They tended to have a lot of kids. And bringing kids into the household, particularly on the farm, was seen as a good thing, just because kids could be very, you know, could contribute to the productivity really early on. Now, kids are a challenge because of the time that they require to raise, and that gets in the way of getting ahead in the corporate world, both for men and women, but particularly for women. For the obvious reason, you know, when a woman bears a child, she's greatly inconvenienced when it comes to being able to do things for her employer. And then you've got maternity leave and all of that. And now paternity leave. Do you think that these things might just sort of be discouraged in subtle ways by employers? I mean, you're still paying these people and they're not around for, in some cases, months and months and months. So there are disincentives at that level. Then there are the cost disincentives. Now the kid doesn't do anything that really contributes to the household wheel or our life, ever. I mean, because the whole childhood experience is just preparing the kid for the market economy. And then just about the time the kid is ready to actually do things that are productive, he's expected or she's expected, increasingly she's expected to leave and kind of set out on his or her own. And if they don't, then, you know, it's shameful. You know, it's an embarrassment. My son still lives in the basement. My daughter still lives in her bedroom, that kind of thing. Now, sometimes they're still in those places for bad reasons. But historically, your children would maybe get married and just literally live right next door. Or, you know, if you were in Boston and you were in a triple decker, you know, live right in the next apartment, that kind of thing. So extended family living brought costs down, made things more productive, but also there was a lot of social help. Think about it this way. So like in my church, we have some pretty, large extended families. These women in my church who have, you know, several children, I mean, in my church, having just four is considered to be a small family. But these women have all these other women to help them and to encourage them, and mothers and sisters who've got time to help out with childcare and stuff like that. So it creates a sort of community because of all of this interdependency and this extended family reality, you know, sort of dynamics that I would say it's less burdensome for a woman in my church who already has maybe six kids to have another than it is for a woman who is, you know, employed full time, and she and her husband are, you know, over their heads with a mortgage, they have to keep, you know, to have just one.
Yeah. Yeah. I watch the families that have a lot, and the way the younger take care of, you know, I mean, the older take care of the younger, and the way that, you know, again, doesn't make everything simple, but it's a little society. It's a little strongly functioning society.
Yeah. When I taught at Calvin College, four was the magic number of kids. Almost everybody had four kids. And I was talking to one of my colleagues, and he said, yeah, you know what? Four is easier than three.
Hmm.
You know, and it's just because of that dynamic where the older help with the younger and everything else. It creates a different kind of family unit.
Well, yeah, the first child very often identifies with the parents against the chaos of the younger children. So it's like a third parent. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
Now, again, the other thing that I think, I mentioned this earlier, but the other thing I think is important here is the political divide that comes up at this point. We are at probably the first time since polls started being taken where more men want to have kids than women. And again, a lot of this has to do with the movement of women left and increasingly men right as a result of, well, frankly, the sense that men are being blamed for everything. And that nothing good is being said about them. You know, their concerns, their needs, their status is being completely dissed. And so that's pushing them to more conservative positions, which not surprisingly then also includes a desire for kids, whereas the women going toward the left also not unnaturally pushes them away from the idea that kids are an important thing.
Yeah. One of the things that's kind of maybe a weird wrinkle to this is I know some women who are lovely young women who are believers who want to have children, but even with these dynamics are not finding men who are really up to snuff, so to speak, or up to the challenge. Mm-hmm. So just because a guy will maybe check a particular box on a survey doesn't mean that he's really willing to make the next step and actually, you know, do the things that are necessary.
Well, you know, the weird thing is that both of my kids, a boy and a girl, both of them had trouble finding spouses. Elizabeth ended up marrying a guy from Sierra Leone because she couldn't find a Christian in America that, you know, that shared her values and her ideas. Brendan ended up finding one, but she's significantly younger than he is, and you know, he didn't get married until he was in his 30s. He wanted to be married in his 20s. You know, so. This is a problem. And like I said, I see it on both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. The cultivation of it's just, there's so many things that have, you know, are missing in terms of, you know, well, good formation. And again, I kind of laugh at my own generation. There's this old joke about Generation Xers is that we turn 30 at age 12 and we're still age 30. But in a sense, I do, you know, not everyone. But there was a maturity level that even some of the people just looking back, they looked much older, but they were 15, 16. And now I get kids in the university and sometimes even graduate school, and they sometimes act as the same level as, you know, 12, you know, 11-year-olds. I mean, just in terms of maturity levels, and you just start to think, you know, yeah, growing up, sometimes having a kid young will help you, you know, force you to grow up. But then sometimes you can really just be, you know, not in a situation where you're given a lot, and that's tough.
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of this has to do with some bad parenting that these younger people have been subject to. So, you know, thinking about my own kids, all my kids are married, all of my kids have kids, and I think, you know, with my wife and I, we were both very committed to talking to them about the next phase of life. And it was more or less assumed, it was assumed that they would get married. And so we would talk about it a lot. We would say, this is what you should look for. These are things you should do. These are things you shouldn't do. And my church that I serve now, that's definitely the case with the families there. I think we've got a lot of great young people, male and female. But I wonder about just whether or not we live in a world where people either don't feel comfortable bringing that assumption to their children, where they're almost like, well, what do you want to do today? But when it comes to just their lives, it's not assumed. But also whether they have anything to tell them, you know, that would be really helpful to the kid.
And then, you know, you kind of couple it with that, you know, a lot of I'm not talking typically just church kids, but on the whole, I mean, more widely culturally, a lot of people are just listening and consuming constantly this just stuff that doesn't prepare you well for relationships, you know? And I meet people all the time who, I got a friend, devout Christian, raised his kids right, but his son is just like, I can't even meet a girl that I want to even take on a date. And we've seen the flip side of this. And just because, not just because of immaturity, but kind of values or the lack thereof. And it is very complicated for younger people. Again, if you have a nice church and that allows for people to meet and connect and move early into that, that's one thing. But sometimes there aren't a lot, you know, there aren't a lot, or they're not connecting, and there's not a lot of options out there, or they can't find them. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Glenn, do you want to kind of help us bring this to a conclusion? we're getting to that time.
Yeah, like I said at the beginning, this is not a movement that I've heard of, but you know, prior to this. But this idea that women, at least some women, under the influence of a really radical form of feminism, are really trying to operate in a society in which there is absolutely no social contact with men. I mean, they may have to work with them and that sort of thing, but that's it. That strikes me just as, you know, as somebody who's worked in the social sciences, that just strikes me as a recipe for disaster. And the question that, there are multiple questions it raises in my mind. First of all, what kind of indoctrination goes into producing people like that? And on a practical level, what are they going to do when they're in their 40s and 50s? Where does this actually leave them a couple of decades down the road? But we're not taught to think that way. The flip side of it is that it seems to me it's producing a great deal of negative reaction among men. Andrew Tate is really popular right now. So the manosphere is alive and well, and it's becoming progressively, by the people who study these things, it's becoming progressively more misogynistic. Largely, I suspect, as a reaction, if not to, you know, 4B itself, as to the kind of feminist trends that produce it. And this is not a viable situation for a society to survive. And I'm, yeah. I'm at this point, I'm literally talking survival.
So, yeah, I think we're going to see this play out in a very sad way. You know, we're already seeing kind of the early indications of that sadness in Korea and in Japan. And I guess at this point, to kind of put a, you know, you know, bring this to an end.
Let me throw in one more thing. This is where the church needs to step up. We can be speaking and modeling a different route, something that's really different. Your church is doing this. Tom's church is doing it. The one I'm attending is doing it. We need to provide a model for good male-female relationships, good families, kids, all of these kinds of things. We got the answer.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point to end on. All right. Well, thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the Theology Pugcast. And a number of folks out there are aware that we're on our way to Oxford, and we're really pleased to be doing that. And we've had some requests for our itinerary, and one of my daughters-in-law is working on that, and she's doing a great job pulling some things together for us. We've got some exciting interviews that we're going to be conducting. We got Alistair McGrath here lined up. We got Michael Ward lined up, and some other folks that we've been having difficulty reaching. My daughter-in-law Whitney has miraculously connected with. Right. I've thought about making her my publicist. I'm not joking. Anyway, but so hopefully we'll have information out about that soon. If you'd like to support our trip, we do have an Indiegogo campaign. It's kind of stalled a bit. But we still could use some help there, and we'll have a link in the show notes for that. And then, of course, we have our ongoing, Patreon, need. We are up to about 12,000 to 15,000 listeners every week between all platforms. But we have less than 100 people who support us on Patreon. So if you'd like to join the team. By the way, that's not all that unusual. I'm told it's about 1% when you have a Patreon page, about 1% of the people who, consume the content, support it. So if you want to be one of those folks, we would appreciate it, either the Indiegogo or the Patreon. Anyway, that's enough for now. Thanks for a good show, Glenn, and thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Theology Pugcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. To learn more about the church, you can visit trinityreformedkirk.com. trinityreformedkirk.com.